They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:09, Wednesday, April 20th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, and I'm wearing this hat in tribute to our missing colleague, John Green, and also as a reminder for John to send me some new hats.
Good morning. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent with Thoroughbred Daily News. I already hear, Joe, you can't see it because I'm wearing the the quarter zip or whatever, but I have my helium t-shirt on underneath this. So remember the long forgotten helium who won the Tampa Bay Derby, and then John sprung for these t-shirts for us. So, we love John, but we love him even more when he gives us this swag.
Huh? Exactly. Us media types, we love free food and free swag. That's two things about us.
For sure. There you go.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. The catalog is now online for the April Horses of Racing Age sale after the races on closing day of the spring meet, which is Friday, April 29th. Approved supplements will be accepted up until sale date. You can visit april.keeneland.com for more details. So it's a little bit of a light show this week. We got a couple of kind of broad scope stories that we're going to talk about, and then we'll do a little bit of racing before we sign off. We're all really prepping for the Keeneland show next week. I'm really excited for that. This Bill mentioned this in his weekend review, and something we've touched on before in the past when we talked about Pennsylvania and the potential of the slot money going away from Pennsylvania. But Pompano Park, which was a pretty popular harness track in Florida, closed over the weekend because the state made it so that the casino money could be separated from the racetrack operations. But Bill knows more about it, so I'll toss it to him.
Yeah, Joe, you would think, why are we on a Thoroughbred podcast talking about Pompano Park? Why was I writing the Thoroughbred Daily News about a harness track? Because this is a much bigger story than just Pompano Park. And, you know, we talked about it with Pennsylvania. As you said, we had similar problems in Canada a few years ago that, you know, the horse racing is so reliant on slot machine money and revenue from casinos. What is the future of this? And we all know at some point in time, this is not sustainable. That the casino companies that run racetracks don't want to run racetracks. They have a lot of political clout. I'm sure they contribute heavily to various legislators, re-election campaigns, et cetera. The casino companies want to get out of the racing business. Can they do it? Well, they're tied to racing, but can they move the ball down the lane so that they can, what is called decoupling? And by and large, we haven't seen really anything too serious when it comes to this. But now in Florida, they passed a bill where all the pari-mutuel facilities but Gulfstream and Tampa, the two thoroughbred facilities, can decouple. I mean, I think within 5 minutes of Ron DeSantis signing that, Pompano Park said, oh, by the way, we're done. And now they can't close Gulfstream and Tampa Bay Downs, which is a good news. I don't think they would anyways. But this is a much bigger story. Is this the first of a domino effect that we're going to see where we are going to see decoupling? It has to happen. The casino companies eventually are going to win this battle. The horsemen's groups mainly have been fighting on the side of the good guys, have done a great job doing it. But, you know, the governor of Pennsylvania keeps trying to pull this off. Like I said, it's always on the front burner in these other states. So it is a cautionary tale. What happened at Pompano Park? Can it happen to XYZ Downs? Can it happen in this state? Can it happen in that state? It absolutely can. And I hate to say it, it's going to happen sooner or later. I don't know if we're going to see massive decouplings within the next 3 or 4 years, but it we're going down this path, whether we like it or not. And I'm not sure there's a whole lot can be done about it. But, you know, Pompano Park, if it can happen there, track that's an historic track in Florida, had great years, was once the winter capital of harness racing. It can happen almost anywhere.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, there's two sides of this coin, because on the one hand, you know, we've seen what companies like Churchill Downs will take advantage of to try to close tracks that they don't particularly have an interest in running. We saw it with Calder, with that loophole to where they put up the Hialeah frontons and were able to close Calder. And we've seen also Churchill try to get out of the business in Illinois, which we all agree was a travesty to close Arlington Park. But I wonder on the flip side of that, you know, we talk on the show about the need for consolidation in this sport and that there are too many tracks still running relative to the demand that there is for racing in America, especially some of these smaller circuits. And listen, I'm not going to get up here and say your track should close, your track should close. Obviously, there are people who need to make a living wherever there's racing. But I just wonder if this kind of becomes the natural selection of racing, because like you said, it's not going to happen at Gulfstream. It's not going to happen at Tampa. It's not going to happen in New York. It's not probably not going to happen in California. It's probably going to happen in some of these smaller, less racing involved states. So I wonder, Bill, do you think that this is necessarily something that's a threat nationwide, or is it only a threat to the smaller, less utilized, lower handled tracks?
Well, Joe, you made a couple of good points there. And number one, I mean, you're right. And again, I don't want to point the finger at any individual racetrack and say this place should close. But we all know there's way too much racing, particularly there's way too much bad racing out there. And I think the sport would be overall better off if there was some detraction there. And there would be if it weren't for the casinos. You know, I've said this, there are dozens of tracks that would not be in business today if it weren't for their attachment to the casinos. But there's also another level of this that we haven't talked about. I mean, I don't think, for instance, in New York, I don't think that anything is imminent in New York. They seem to have the NYRA and the horsemen and whatever seem to have good relationships with government and whatnot. But what if you took the slot money away from New York racing? It's about 35% of the purse money. Racing would continue in New York, but those $80,000 purses would then be $50,000 purses. And with the casino slot historical racing money just inundating, coming in like they're printing money in the basement at Oaklawn and in Kentucky, could New York racing, you know, be on the same par as Kentucky? So you have those kind of separate issues there. But, you know, let's go back to and even like take a place like Pennsylvania, which is somewhere in between. It's not New York, but it's not Charlestown either. And this is where the governor unsuccessfully, but on two occasions, has tried to take all the casino money away from Pennsylvania. I don't think any of the racetracks in Pennsylvania could survive without it. I think they would close the next day, and then you would lose, you know, a good racetrack in parks and, you know, races like the Pennsylvania Derby and the Cotillion. So there are so many different chapters to this or branches you could go down. But, you know, back to your original point. Yeah, I mean, it is kind of good news, bad news. I think by and large, we don't want this to happen at all because it's a slippery slope. And that's what I tried to point out with the story about Pompano. This just isn't about Pompano. Caesars Entertainment figured out a way to do this. And I don't know if they own any other tracks or not, but you can darn well if they do, that the executives are sitting in their offices in Las Vegas as we speak saying, okay, we did this in Florida. How are we going to do this in this state or that state? And then their competitors, MGM or whomever, is going to say the same thing. So I think by and large, we don't want to see this happen because, you know, the real fear is this is a trickle. One racetrack, a harness racetrack at that, in a state where they said you can't do it with thoroughbred racing. But does this open up the floodgates? I think that's the real story here.
Yeah, and like you said, Pompano in your story, Pompano is a popular place relative for harness tracks. So, and same thing with Arlington, like obviously a different situation somewhat with Arlington. But I think it's one of those things where, like I said, natural selection. It shouldn't happen to tracks where there is a lot of business and there is growth and there is actually an attempt, like you said in your story, from the management at Pompano to, you know, advertise and market and bring more people to the track and bring more handle. You said that they had had record handle basically over the past few years relative to what they had. And I think that those are the tracks that need to stick around. My only point on the flip side is that, you know, slot money has become, I think, a crutch for a lot of racetracks and a lot of people who run racetracks, to where there is no incentive to grow the product. There is no incentive to market and bring in more wagering dollars because they're always going to have that slot revenue to underwrite all of their expenses. So I think I would agree that if we can make it so that only the crappy tracks get thrown out, like I think that that necessarily would not be a terrible thing for racing. But like you said, there's no real stopping that snowball once it starts going downhill. Once these states start realizing that they can, you know, and these companies start realizing that they can cut costs by getting rid of racing, I agree that it's going to be hard to control if this kind of thing.
Right.
You know,
right. But racing also needs to look at itself in the mirror. And there are no easy answers to this, I understand. But let's go back to Arlington Park, which is not really a decoupling situation.
Right.
It's where it falls into its own category. But if Arlington Park, you know, I don't know if it was losing a ton of money, losing a little bit of money, mildly profitable, but we could rest assured that it was not really a very profitable operation. You have a racetrack in Chicago, third biggest city in the country, I believe, with a great history, a beautiful facility, but it wasn't making enough money for Churchill Downs to say, we're going to keep it going. Now, they weren't going to put the casino there because they didn't want to compete with the other casino. But if Churchill Downs at the bottom of at the end of the year was looking at their ledger sheets and saying, wow, we made $25 million. I'm just picking that number out of the clear blue sky, running Arlington Park last year, it wouldn't have been closed down. That racetracks on their own, these racetracks are either unprofitable or just barely squeaking by on the racing product. That's a huge problem. How do you change that? I don't know that you can. And that gets back to, Gulfstream Park, and the Stronach Group is, we like the Stronach Group for a lot of reasons, one of which is they like horse racing. So I'm sure they made no effort whatsoever to get Gulfstream involved in this decoupling thing. But why is Gulfstream not going anywhere? Because they handle on Florida Derby Day $45 million. That's why. And whereas, Pompano Park up the road, up 95, was all excited about, they had a $1.7 million handle. They handle that on the first race at Gulfstream. So of the day. So, again, horse racing needs to look itself in the mirror. And look, it's above our pay grade to figure out how to solve these problems. But, if you want horse racing to stick around at a place like Arlington Park, if you don't want it to go away at parks, find a way to make it more successful and profitable. Is there a magic bullet? Probably not. But yeah, let's not completely just whine and complain about, oh, this big bad casino company put us out of business. Well, they wouldn't be putting you out of business if you were making money.
TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. We'll be at Keeneland next week. Can't wait. Be sure to check out the catalog for the April Horses of Racing Age sale. Mystic Knight, who was an impressive allowance winner on Friday at Keeneland, is going to be selling his Hip 61 with tailor-made sales. And there are going to be many other active up-and-coming racehorses offered that day. I looked at the catalog. Actually, a lot of really, really nice horses that you could probably turn around in a quick time and race this summer and this fall. So definitely check out the catalog. It was a great weekend of racing at Keeneland as well last week. And there were several high-profile Keeneland sales grads in the winner's circle, including Grade 1 Jenny Wiley Stakes winner Regal Glory. Chad Brown, as we're going to talk about a little bit later, picked up his record fifth win in the Jenny Wiley. Regal Glory was picked up for $925,000 at last year's Keeneland January sale. And Grade 3 Stone Street Lexington winner Tawny Port was a $430,000 Keeneland September graduate. Now we look forward to this coming week of racing. We're going to talk a little bit more about it later, including the Grade 3 Double Dog Dare on Friday and the Grade 2 Elkhorn and Grade 3 Ben Elliott Stakes on Saturday. Then just a few days later, as I mentioned, we'll be on site at Keeneland for our live show. Really looking forward to it. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
With all eyes on the bluegrass this spring, there's no better way to take in the action than Friday, April 29th at Keeneland.
And they're off.
We get into it with hip number one. Good luck.
Featuring a day filled with world-class racing, followed by a unique sales experience in the evening. The April Horses of Racing Age sale. After the races on closing day of the spring meet. Follow the action this April to Keeneland.
He was just put together like a machine, and he had a great mind. Everything about him was what you'd want.
Tis the Law pops the cork in the champagne.
Tis the Law is going to win the first leg of the Triple Crown.
I've never seen him get tired.
Respect the Law. Tis the Law.
His structure is just perfect. His bone is perfect.
He's left the others behind. He's going to win the Run Happy Travers.
He's everything you would look for in a horse.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Coolmore. We're just one session into the OBS April 2-year-old sale, but Coolmore sires are already making headlines. Uncle Mo had the session one topper yesterday after breezing in 9-4. The 2-year-old colt brought $2.3 million going to Gary Young. Earlier in the day, Justify had a colt who breezed in 10 flat, sell for $600,000. Cupid, my boy, can't wait to see you next week. At his first champion last week when his son, God of Love, was named Canadian champion 2-year-old male. So congratulations to the connections there. Trained by Mark Cassie, the colt won last year's Cup and Saucer Stakes and Grade 3 Gray Stakes at Woodbine. American Pharaoh was also represented by Canadian champion older main track female Sky Gaze, who won last year's Grade 3 Maple Leaf Stakes. And first crop sire Motown had his first winner last Wednesday at Keeneland after his son, Mr. Gordy, named after, obviously, the Motown founder, won on debut for trainer John Hancock. Motown has about a dozen two-year-olds up for grabs this week at OBS, so definitely take a look if you're down in Ocala. All right, so in the last segment, we talked about something that kind of has a negative portend for racing's future, perhaps. This is something that I think is a positive development, and especially for the horses themselves going forward. Dan Ross had a really fascinating story last week in the TDN called The Missing Link, or actually earlier this week, The Missing Link to End Fatal Musculoskeletal Injuries, ? And it's about these new initiatives that veterinarians and some tracks are taking on to try to detect horses who have potentially fatal underlying issues before they come to the forefront, before the horses actually break down themselves. This is something that California, I think, has done a good job on, has been at the forefront of ever since those injuries a handful of years ago with the PET scans and the MRI scans to try to detect these injuries before they happen in racehorses. But now it's happening in other big jurisdictions. NYRA is implementing a new program. First Racing is implementing a new program. You can read all about it, but it's a really fascinating idea. And the main program that Dan talks about in the story is called Stride Safe. And it's this little chip that that you put in the horse's saddle towel, and it can detect the movements, like the tiny little different movements that a horse might make if there's some underlying distress there that might not necessarily show up in an outward injury and something that the horse definitely needs to go on the shelf for. That's something that's easily detectable by a regular vet. And it's another one of these kind of technologies, the movement tracking things that are becoming so popular in other sports as well. And it's so much more important in horse racing, because if you read the story, there are such small variations in a horse's stride that even the jockey can't pick up. Even the jockey probably cannot feel in most situations the horse's stride changing. And it happens even sometimes in horses that run well. There was an anecdote in the piece about a horse who had, you know, not run that well for a few starts and then ran second. Everybody figures, okay, the horse is coming into her top form, and the horse broke down. But if you had paid attention to the data from the saddle towel technology, then you would have been able to figure out that there was something underneath the surface that was coming up. And it breaks down the horse's stride into basically a traffic light: green, yellow, or red. Green means everything is all good. Yellow means it's okay. And red means there's something to be worried about. And I'm just going to read some quotes here. It says that the sensor is the ultimate jockey, like I was saying. It's the best rider that ever rode a horse. I'm quoting the guy who's in charge of this program, David Lambert, who's a veterinarian. It's the best rider that ever rode a horse, never forgets anything, and picks up data 800 times a second in each of the three directions for a total of 2,400 data points a second from the horse. And he went on to say, a horse can basically stand to race. Their bones are strong enough. Their ligaments are strong enough. But what they can't stand is imperfection over and over and over again. They're going to break something. What I'm quoting Dan's story as well. When explaining the equine biometrics underpinning the success of the Stride Safe technology, Lambert first compares the horse to a cousin, the kangaroo. He says, people don't get that. 60 or 70% of the energy it produces is to go fast is from spring or elastic recoil. And then he breaks down the horse's stride. It's a fascinating story. Honestly, Bill, I'm going to come back to a lot of different points from this, because I think it's really interesting. And this is the kind of thing that I think, you know, racing should promote this. Racing should promote, here's what we're doing to try to stop horses from breaking down. It's not just about racetrack safety. It's not just about drugs. It's about being able to detect these injuries early on. But Bill, what were your impressions from the story?
Well, Joe, I'll get sort of the macro picture here, because you went over a lot of the details. You know, we've been told over the last several years that, like you said, a breakdown comes at the end of a progression of a brewing problem. A perfectly healthy horse doesn't go out and necessarily break down. It's the horse that has some sort of problem that's undetectable, and it gets worse and worse and worse and then breaks down. And that if you can nip this in the bud, if you can find these problems before you put the horse in jeopardy in a race, that is, you know, obviously a tremendous benefit. And, you know, so there's so much technology out there. And you know, I think it's right. This was such a big story and so promising. I was wondering, you know, why you and I didn't even know about this, which is, you know, is a kind of a whole nother different topic. But, you know, the bigger picture, we talk so much about, you know, okay, the number of breakdowns has been going down. And isn't that, you know, good news? But we're still at a point that is unacceptable. You know, there are too many horses break down, too many horses die in races. Can we get it to zero? We've always said no. And I don't think we can ever get it to zero. But can we get it to a number that is half of what it is now, or 25% of what it is now? Reading Dan's story, it certainly seems like we can. And, you know, that is absolutely great news and, you know, is going to be, if in fact this happens. And it certainly seems like this was not like wishful thinking either, or a lot of maybes. It sounded like this is going to happen. And, you know, let's get that number down to as small as it possibly can be. And it's great news for the industry.
Yeah, totally. And then just to emphasize the point that I was making before, reading from the story, it says, how prevalent are these sorts of issues, these sorts of underlying issues? It says 21 of the 22 horses that died during Santa Anita's 2018-2019 winter meet showed pre-existing pathology at the site of their fatal injuries. So that's a huge number. That's like over 95%. So I think a lot of us didn't necessarily realize how important it was, how important this early detection kind of stuff is to stop horses from breaking down. I think a lot of us assumed it's the racetrack, like I said, or the drugs, or maybe the way that horses are trained, or maybe the too many cheap horses running. There are a lot of factors, but it seems like this is the main one. And it, you know, it's kind of amazing that it took this long for racing to try to figure this out, but it's awesome that people are on the case now, and really smart people are on the case. And just to show some examples of the way that StrideSafe has been used, quoting from the story, it says, last summer, NYRA used StrideSafe on every horse in one race per day at Saratoga, allotting each the requisite red, yellow, or green label. By the end of the meet, 3% of horses measured had been red flagged. It says all participants were then tracked over the subsequent 4 months to see if and when they returned to race day competition. Of the green horses, 78% were able to race back within 4 months. Of the yellow horses, 72% raced within 4 months, but only 40% of the red flagged horses returned to race within 4 months. Again, that seems to be pretty important and conclusive data. Obviously, it's a small sample size, but still, that's a big, big difference. And says, so impressed has Scott Palmer, who's the equine medical director for the New York State Gaming Commission, so impressed has Palmer been with the technology. NYRA has now used it on every horse to race during the most recent Belmont Park and Aqueduct meets for a number totaling roughly 6,000 recordings. So that data is now being evaluated, and says plans are also afoot to trial the technology on horses during training. And says Palmer already imagines a future where this technology is a more permanent part of the NYRA furniture. He says, my vision about this is that when I can get notified of a red alert, I can just send an email to the trainer that says, trainer, your horse got a red alert today. What does it mean? What does it not mean? And what are your next steps? Says the horse is going to start to get extra scrutiny so that they can try to prevent injuries during a race. You know, I wonder if this can kind of be folded in maybe to the HISA safety program, because, you know, obviously I haven't read all of the HISA regulations, but this is the kind of stuff that I think if we're going to have, you know, a nationally unified safety policy and protocol, this needs to be part of it. We need to have this kind of technology because it's out there and a lot of the main tracks are using it. But Bill, you know, what do you think? Do you think that this feasibly could be adopted across the country?
I mean, why not? Especially under HISA. I mean, I guess, you know, there'd be a cost factor, and that's when we have no idea what this costs. You know, would a smaller racetrack or a racing commission in a state where there's not a lot of revenue, would they be able to do something like this? You know, and then another thing, Joe, you know, it's interesting, I'm sure this is all a work in progress, but you talk about these horses that get the red flags running back within a certain amount of time. I mean, I would think the next upshoot of this would be there's got to be some sort of rule and regulation. If you get a red light or a red flag, you know, maybe you shouldn't even ever race again. Maybe that's a little bit too draconian, but I would think that, you know, if you get a red flag and the trainer wants to run it back, the horse back 3 weeks later, you, would have to say, no, this absolutely can't be. You know, was the horse maybe put on the stewards list for 6 months, something like that? So I think as this progresses, that that's an issue that we have to deal with, because, you know, what we've been doing with this research so far is finding out in hindsight, okay, this horse broke down and here's why. Well, let's not get to that point where, you know, the horse is put into a race after having a red flag and is in jeopardy. So, you know, that's another thing. But again, I'm sure that this is a, you know, there's a lot of moving parts here and this is a developing story.
Yeah. And I think that's the main idea, is to put this into practice and to actually have some teeth behind it. Because like you said, right now it's for research purposes. And that's why I bring up HISA, because it's the kind of thing that has authority over all of racing theoretically. And it's the kind of thing where you need some kind of oomph behind the research and someone who can say, listen, you're not allowed to race this horse for X amount of days, X amount of months, or maybe ever, because Dan was talking about how eventually you would like to filter these horses out of the racing population in general. Now, obviously, people will have complaints and be like, well, you complain about field size and shrinking field size and you want to decrease the horse population, but then maybe decoupling will come in and decrease some of the tracks too. We'll have some bigger field sizes. But no, I mean, yeah, this is the kind of thing that, like I said, should be at the forefront and should be talked about and should be promoted when people, you know, trash the sport and you know, PETA comes calling after us. This should be pointed to say, look, we got some really, really smart people and some actual money and some actual research behind trying to prevent these things from happening. So it's not as if we're at a point where I think we used to be, where we just kind of brush it under the rug every time a horse broke down. This has become the North Star for a lot of people is in racing now, is to get rid of breakdowns as much as possible. And I think this is really encouraging that there are so many people focused on early detection, because that's the kind of thing that's a very quiet, under the radar problem that it really helps to have so many smart people and these pilot programs behind figuring out that those issues and solving them before they obviously result in catastrophe. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by the Pennsylvania Horse Breeders Association. Pennsylvania Breds were very well represented at the Keeneland meet when just one time got our first grade one win in the Madison Stakes for Warriors Reward LLC and Commonwealth New Era Racing. She looks to have a very exciting campaign up ahead of her this year for Brad Cox. The PHBA also recently announced their board's approval of a code of ethics from their anti-slaughter committee that will begin May 1st. It must be signed by anyone who either registers a horse or becomes a member of the PHBA, pledging not to knowingly cause a thoroughbred horse to be slaughtered for commercial purposes. If a person directly or indirectly violates this rule, it will be subject to sanctions set forth by the PHBA. I think that that's also relates to what we were talking about in the last segment, is that there's some teeth behind making sure that horses don't end up in the slaughter pipeline. So shout out to the PHBA. I think that that's a great initiative. And I hope obviously it works out and trainers and owners do the right things by their horses. So good job by the PHBA, because that's another kind of underlying problem in racing that we need people in power to take steps to solve. So we'll be right back after this message from the PHBA.
The PA Horse Breeders Association introduces the Pennsylvania Stallion Series. Four brand new races to be run at parks for PA-sired, PA-bred two-year-olds. There are two $100,000 contests on August 22nd, PA Day at the Races. September 24th, PA Derby Day, has two more races, each with a $200,000 purse. The PA Stallion Series, yet another reason why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race. For more, please visit PABred.com.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So this is such a treat and such a thrill for us to bring on national political correspondent for MSNBC and also now for Football Night in America and the NBC horse racing coverage, Steve Kornacki. Thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, Joe, Bill, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's so good to talk to you. It's a real thrill for us to have you on. You are a national treasure, I must say. And, you know, people might see you on the MSNBC broadcast and breaking down all the election coverage and not know that you're a horse player and you're a horse racing guy. So my first question is, how do you typically play the races? What kind of bets? And now that you're on the NBC horse racing coverage, do you find yourself betting and handicapping more now that's part of your job?
It's how do I play him? Probably unwisely and too aggressively.
Me too.
You know, I can't help myself in some ways. I'm kind of a sucker for, you know, always trying to find a price, always trying to find a long shot. You know, get myself in trouble, throwing out too many favorites, going against Chad Brown too much in New York, you know, that kind of thing. I enjoy the challenge. I know some people have kind of likened it to, you know, a puzzle, trying to put a puzzle together, you know, fit 1,000 different pieces. And, you know, if you can ever get the combination just right, there's this, you know, feeling of kind of satisfaction. And I don't need to describe it to you guys, a real rush that comes with that. So I guess I'm always kind of chasing that rush. And yeah, I don't know. I was on, we did, three of the final prep races, you know, on NBC a couple weeks ago. We did, the Wood, the Bluegrass, the Santa Anita. They did ask me, I think they were trying to spare me the embarrassment if I wanted to pick them on the air or not. I said, sure, I'll go ahead and take some shots. So I went over three, but, I knew that was a distinct possibility. You know, and it was one of those, I did find myself, there was sort of a gut check there, definitely in the Bluegrass and the Wood. I went for some prices, and there was a part of me that was saying, hey, maybe go with, go with like a Mo Donegal or something in the Wood. It might be a safer pick than I ended up going with Barise, who will not be going to the Derby. So, but I, you know, that's kind of how I approach it. I'm always more interested in 8-1 than 2-1. And
well, Steve, let's take even one more step backwards. And I've heard the story before, but I never get tired of hearing it. How does a kid growing up in New England, his immediate family not involved in horse racing, how'd you get involved and interested in the sport, particularly from the gambling and handicapping side?
Yeah, I mean, it goes way back for me. I do have an uncle who's really into it just as a horse player. And he took me for the very first time to Scarborough Downs in Southern Maine, which is now no longer in existence. They lasted a while, but a harness track. This would have been in like the late 1980s. I mean, they didn't even have simulcasting at that point. So it was just the live harness track at Scarborough. And you know, he would go like every Friday in the summer. So he brought me once, and I was a real little kid, you know, handed me the program. He's basically babysitting me for the night. And I, you know, before each race, I would just, you know, point to who I wanted, and I ended up picking. I got to pick five, and he bet zero of them. So I've had that over him for about 30 years now, and I've also never had another night like that since.
You know, you were talking. I heard you talk about how you hadn't been to the Derby before last year when you did it for NBC, correct?
Yeah, that was my first time actually being there, and it was, you know, of the three big, you know, Triple Crown races last year, it was the one that felt the most normal just in terms of the crowd being back. It, you know, wasn't full capacity, but it definitely felt it. And it was, weather was amazing. And it was kind of everything I imagined it would be.
Yeah. Well, you picked Medina Spirit, I believe. I think you were the only guy on the broadcast who picked Medina Spirit.
Yeah. I used to be able to say I picked the winner, but I guess I won't be able to, but you, they won't get the money back at least.
You picked the winner. You're not responsible for everything that's happened since then with Medina Spirit. You had the right horse. But yeah, so what was that experience like? You know, did it live up to expectations? Like you said, it wasn't full capacity, but what was the pageantry and everything like for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things just for me, just in terms of being on site, is I've seen so many of these. It feels like in the last 10 years, every other year, it's been pouring rain down there. So first of all, when I found out I was going, I was like, I just want nice weather. And it was like a perfect day for it. And you got, you know, I think they officially capped it at about 50,000 again. Like I swear there actually were more people than that. It certainly felt that way. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't what I've seen at its, you know, biggest on television. But, you know, you see the people dressing up, the dresses, the mint juleps, the attire, the hats. There's just
my old Kentucky home.
Yeah. There's a pageantry. There's an energy, you know, obviously it's just sort of coursing through the place all day. You know, I mean, the undercard races, so many of those are just good races too. On top of everything else. So, and I mean, you've got the Oaks the day before. We had great weather for that too. I was really fortunate last year to get to do all three of them. The Derby was, you know, it met my expectations and then some, and really eager to get back down there again this year.
Before I give a question to Steve, a little anecdote, and Joe, I think you'll get a kick out of this. I've known Steve for a little while now, and I've written about him. I've had enjoyed having dinner with him. And obviously, I had no idea that this guy was a horse player. And I'm watching the primary, the returns from New Hampshire. And the votes are coming in from an area in southern New Hampshire. And Steve says they're coming in from so-and-so, Salem County, which is where Rockingham Racetrack was. I said, what? Wait a minute. He knows where Rockingham was? This guy's got to be a racing fan and a player. And lo and behold, I went to Dave Johnson, a friend of both of ours. He says, yeah, I know Steve. And he loves racing. And we got together. So this all started with a little reference in the New Hampshire primary, which I'm watching, Rockingham Park. So if I am the one who discovered Steve as a racing guy, that's where it all came from. But back to the question, Steve, on your work on MSNBC and the election results, you do such a fantastic job of breaking down the numbers. What do they mean? There's 10% of the vote left to be counted in so-and-so state, and that's good news for the Democrats because some of the Democratic areas haven't been counted, et cetera. How do you bring that approach to horse racing? And on the Kentucky Derby broadcast, I mean, it's really kind of apples and oranges between politics, yes and no, but people still love the numbers and the breakdowns. What are you hoping to accomplish on your racing work so far as letting the viewer know, given some insights that maybe they wouldn't have if you weren't on the broadcast?
Yeah, thanks. I love the shout out for the late lamented The Rock in Salem, yes. New Hampshire. Yeah, I spent plenty of time there. I loved Rockingham Park. That was actually the closest one to us where I grew up. I think maybe the comparison in terms of what I do politically, with sort of election data, and what I try to do, with horse racing is the comparison is in the run up to the election and the run up to, whatever race we're on for, where you're looking for potential angles that could provide some insight, some context. In an election year, it would be, here, this just comes to the top of my head. In 2020, we were very mindful that the polls had kind of systematically failed in 2016. They had undercounted Trump support. They had overestimated Democratic support. So one thing we were always trying to adjust for in the month leading up to the election was, here's our polling average in each state. We're going to show you what the average is. And now what we're going to do is we're going to adjust it and say, if the same error applies in 2020 that applied in 2016, here's what the numbers look like now. And suddenly, you went from Biden blowouts to these razor thin Biden margins. And turns out it's pretty much exactly what happened on election night. It's why it ended up stretching into election week and everything else that sort of happened around that. So, that's the kind of thing we're looking for, the kind of context we're looking to provide when it comes to elections. And I think that's the kind of thing. I'm just starting to look at this Kentucky Derby field now and start to look, what can I kind of contribute there on race day, kind of in a run up to it. And I think you're looking for something, which horse, which prep races have had the best track record, or which horse, kind of closed the strongest, had that best final furlong time, buyer speed figures, what kind of early speed is, I think a big one is, in the Derby, you guys know this, obviously, in this points era, just being at or near the front of the pack, like at every point of call, has just been, huge and a total departure from what it was before. So, looking for those kinds of angles in whether it's politics or horse racing.
Bill mentioned this, so much about the different counties in America. I mean, so that's, to me, is the most impressive part of your coverage is, not only do you know the counties, but the specific parts of the counties. That is super impressive. How do you keep that in? Is it just good memory? Do you travel around the country a lot and really get to learn these places? How do you keep all that in your mind?
It depends. I guess I haven't traveled, I think I'm at 43 states right now. So I haven't gotten, I added North Dakota a couple of years ago. So it's 44. I was in Louisiana 2 weeks ago. So I'm
North Dakota before Louisiana.
Yeah. I did a road trip with a friend on Route 2, covering some of those northern states up near Canada. It was kind of cool. So I'm at about 44 or 50. But no, it's just I think that, I find the things I'm interested in, I learn as much as I possibly can about them. But I think it also means I've got vast blind spots. So if I'm on a bar trivia team or something and it's pop music or like any pop culture from maybe the last 20 years or so, I'm kind of useless. So I've got my spots.
Since we veered off from horse racing questions, I have one question I have to ask Steve more about his general work. You call razor thin margin for Biden. This election wasn't called for several days after the first Tuesday in November. And I understand not all of our listeners or people tuning into this will be aware of Steve's work because, you know, we have CNN viewers, we have Fox viewers, et cetera. And, you know, then there's people that that tune into MSNBC that tend to be obviously more liberal. How much over a period of time from, when you started working on that Tuesday to when the Associated Press gave the election to Biden, how much sleep did you get in the course of those hours? Yeah. Because, I mean, what you did was just unbelievable.
Iron Man. It's like Iron Man stuff.
It was. I don't know the number. It was single digits. I remember it was the Thursday night of that week the thing that was happening as that Thursday night, we were getting a lot of the votes suddenly were coming in from Pennsylvania. And Trump had that initial large margin in Pennsylvania. And it was clear Biden was going to overtake him. And it was starting to look at like 11 o'clock or so Thursday night that, hey, if they keep counting these a few more hours, he may overtake him overnight. And obviously, if that happens, that could be the election, you know, right there. And so we, you know, on set, I've got the screen in front of me where I'm actually plugged in the counties that were making their that put cameras in their vote counting centers. I have them, you know, queued up like a Delaware County, Pennsylvania. And you can actually see, hey, there's people there. The lights are on. They're still counting. So my boss comes to me and it's sort of like, you know, I can get you, you know, relief overnight, get a few hours of sleep, come back in the morning. And I said to him, I kind of shook him off. I was like, you know, no, I think, you know, next few hours we might have real movement in Pennsylvania. I've put all this time out, you know. So I wave him off. He sends the other guy home and, you know, I go back on set and then I look at that screen in front of me and suddenly all these different vote counting centers, the lights go off. And I realized they're sending him home for the night and there's going to be no more votes from Pennsylvania that night. And now I'm stuck till, you know, 8 a.m. And well into the next day. So that Thursday night one was my fault. But once it starts, you just want to be there for the end of it. The thing that killed me in 2020 was, you know, the Breeders' Cup was that Friday and Saturday. So I got out of there. They called it at 11:37 Saturday morning. And obviously I was spent and I told my boss, I was like, look, I got nothing else to contribute. I, you know, we're at the finish line now. Have everybody else talk about it. But I also wanted to get out of there and watch the rest of the Breeders' Cup.
just in time to fire away at the Breeders' Cup. You know, one of the other things that came from the 2020 election coverage, you were named one of people's sexiest men alive. what was your reaction to that?
I tell people that's where the real voter fraud was in the in 2020. It's not worth it for all the grief I get from friends and family over it. So.
That's a distinction, man. No, I would wear that with pride.
Yeah, no, I'm as bashful as anyone.
Steve, one of our sponsors on the podcast is West Point Thoroughbreds. We love their outfit. We love everything that they do. You are a West Point client, which I know from talking to you. Why don't you tell us about who you own, what the experience has been like?
Yeah, I figured I'd give it a shot. You know, I've always kind of been interested in seeing the sport from that side of it, from the ownership side of it, because it's sort of like I was saying, as a bettor, you know, when I see 3 to 5, I immediately say, let's beat this horse. Let's try to get, you know, something else here. But, you know, the experience of an owner having a 3 to 5 favorite is going to be very different. And I sort of like, I'm curious what that, you know, what that perspective would be like. So I heard really good things about West Point and got in touch with them and basically in the last year became a partner in two of their horses. So, you know, got 2 2-year-olds last year. One, a filly named Gallon of Rush, actually had a really, really good 2-year-old season. And I when I got into it, I went into it kind of eyes wide open, you know, people telling me, look, you know, this is, you know, you may have 2 complete duds here. This may, you know, you may see nothing on any of this. So, you know, we had a 2-year-old who ended up going off in the Matron Stakes last year, I think at 29-1. And she made this just incredible run, lost by a neck. I think could have gone to the Breeders' Cup potentially had she won that race. So a total success. I think she's going to make her season debut you know, potentially this week, in fact, at Gulfstream with an eye towards, you know, winning some stakes this year. And then the other is named Bourbon Ready. And I think, you know, he's what you call a work in progress. So we'll see what happens.
Well, good luck with those two, and good shout out to the partners all at West Point. Let's talk Derby. You know, you've been on the Derby trail a little bit more, I would assume, this year than in previous years before you were working on the NBC horse racing coverage. What are your early impressions? Who do you like? Who do you think, like you said, you're against short prices? Who do you think is going to take a lot of money that might be a toss? What are your feelings?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those, which I was mentioning this a minute ago. It's yeah, I'm looking a horse like Zandon, I've got real doubts about, just because the way the race has unfolded in the points era. If you're, you know, Mo Donegal too, I think you put into this category, coming off the pace, and just it again, it's outside of Orb in 2013. I was just looking at the actual numbers the other day. I mean, the winner has been the winner, or the horse that, you know, crossed the finish line first, I guess we got to put it that way, you know, has been top three at like the, you know, quarter mile, half mile. I mean, every year except that Orb year. So those closers, it's just, you know, the sort of the pace scenario has changed in the points era. I know a lot of people chalk that up to the, you know, those like pure sprinters not being in it anymore. The points kind of remove them from consideration. Although interestingly, when I ran the numbers the other day, because I was thinking this might be an interesting thing to do on the air, the average speed for the first half mile is actually a little bit slower now than it was in the 20 years before the point system. So there might be a little bit more to it. I'm not sure. But anyway, it makes me skeptical of a horse, you know, of a Zandon. It makes me skeptical of a Mo Donegal, as impressive as they are. I just don't know that it matches this race. Although then, you know, there's the other side of me that starts to say, hey, you know, maybe this is the year that there's enough speed kind of piled up in there, and you actually do get some kind of meltdown scenario, and one of these horses can come, you know, flying in from kind of, you know, way out of it. But initially those two, I'm a little skeptical of. I don't have a favorite yet. I've had a few different thoughts along the way. There's this sentimental part of me that was, if you'd asked me about 3 weeks ago, I was starting to believe in Secret Oath, the filly. And, you know, could a filly win the Arkansas Derby, go to the, you know, yeah, so I was kind of starting to believe in that. Yeah, again, what kind of better am I? I'll bet with my heart and not my head a lot. That would be a, you know, the kind of horse I would do it on. So I don't have a favorite yet. I've probably got like six or eight that I keep kind of jumping back and forth between in my head.
Well, Steve, you've been holding out on us because you haven't told our listeners the real secret to your success as a horse player is that you have a system. It's not the most sophisticated system in the world, but you have a lot of fun with it. And then every once in a while, it helps you stumble upon a big long shot. Why don't you unveil the Steve Kornacki secret to parimutuel riches at the racetrack?
I love it. It's not the Steve Kornacki system, though. It got to my uncle from a guy who went by the name Sharky, who worked at Suffolk Downs in Boston in the 1960s. And actually, I told this to the NBC folks. I told this system, if you want to call it that, to them when I started doing the horse racing. And they kind of like, they loved the simplicity of it. So we did some hits around it. And then it turned out last year, I just found some random, I forgot who it was, but some random account I saw on Twitter that was kind of based in New England, made reference to the system and to Suffolk Downs in the 1960s. So I think it really was a thing that came out of Suffolk Downs in the 60s somehow. But it's 13 system is what it is. And it's, you take the last three finishes for a horse, and if they add up to 13, hammer it. So, you know, eighth place, second place, you know, third place adds up to 13. That's a 13 horse. You hammer it. So I got that from my uncle, and that was, you know, when he started taking me in my earliest years, that would be my job. He'd hand me the program and I'd go through it and I would just find all the 13s. And what it does, I will say, is like, I think especially if you're doing any kind of exotics, if you're doing exact a try, or if you're doing doubles, pick threes, and if you are disciplined and throw the 13 horses in, oftentimes you're going to get 12 to 1, 18 to 1, 20 to 1 horses that you would never in a million years, you know, identify. And they do hit some, as is my experience. They miss a lot, but they do hit sometimes. And I've seen some and been part of with my uncle, some just monster payouts, you know, especially like I said, these doubles, these pick threes, they take up one leg. And, you know, we had one. I was we were all together, my family, probably about a month ago, and we were doing Aqueduct on a Saturday. And there was 13. He went off at 29-1 and he went gate to wire, won the race. We had the double. Only reason we had that horse. Never ever would have had it otherwise. So, you know, you get to the Derby, of course, you don't have many 13s that are running in the Derby because their past performances are, you know, first place, second place, third place, you know, all that. There was one running in the Lexington Stakes last weekend, Dash Attack, but didn't represent the system well.
You know, yeah, I've learned from my years playing the horses, there is no system that you can dismiss. It's a hard enough game that anything that anybody has that's had some success along the way, I think you have to have a little bit of respect for. This is the last question for me. And I usually ask this of people. We talk to athletes on the show sometimes. We talk to Bobby Flay. I ask them about this. People who are in other worlds but are into horse racing. What is the reaction and what is the feeling that you get if you ever talk to colleagues about racing, good, bad, in between? What's the impression that other people have of racing right now, would you say?
I think it varies. You know, sometimes, you know, I'll talk to someone who's got, you know, good memories maybe of going as a kid. Or who, you know, yeah, I go to Saratoga once every summer sort of as a social thing. And so you've got kind of that level of it, you know, I know some folks who like I can, well, I talked some friends into going to Aqueduct last Saturday. I don't know. I can't say they were too impressed, but, you know, Saratoga or something, you know, you can get people who are not too into it, excited about something like that. But yeah, there's, you know, the whole Medina Spirit saga, unfortunately, I think over the last year, when you mention it now, that comes up. The idea of just, you know, didn't that prove that this, you know, the thing isn't on the up? And I think the general impression a lot of people took is that, you know, it's just not on the it's just not on the level. You know, I feel bad just like, you know, obviously it's just how things turned out for that horse. And you know, like I said, to put aside whatever you, I just, the horse to me deserves and deserved better. You know, I'm not weighing in on the, should Baffert have this penalty or that penalty or whatever, but
you do plenty of that on this show. So you're good.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel the horse was a real, had a real, was a real gutty horse and I yeah. really liked the horse and. But yeah, it is. It's when I, you know, certainly in the last year when I mention it, that's not far from the casual person's mind.
Right. Steve, we appreciate you coming on. And as a New Yorker, I appreciate you trying to get people out to Aqueduct before they close it down. You do obviously great work and we're all big fans of you, Steve. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. This was fun.
Thanks, Steve. It was great.
Great stuff.
Take care.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Steve Kornacki, receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. This week's XBTV Workout of the Week features simplification. We worked 5 furlongs in 101.83 on Friday at Gulfstream Park, which you can see on the screen right now. The Kentucky Derby hopeful won this year's Mucho Macho Man Stakes and Fountain of Youth Stakes and was most recently 3rd in the Grade 1 Florida Derby at Gulfstream. He's slated to work again this Friday and next Friday before leaving for Churchill. Definitely a little bit of a under-the-radar contender. I think you might get a good price on him because he ran 3rd in his last race. But if you want to see any of those Kentucky Derby or Oaks hopefuls in the lead-ups to the big race, a big race is coming up on the first weekend in May. You can always go to xbtv.com. Just type in the horse's name. They'll almost certainly have it, so definitely go check that out. not a huge racing weekend last week. We're kind of like in that little lull now between the big Derby preps weekend and then the Derby and Oaks weekend. So obviously we got a ton of great undercard races on those 2 days that we also had the preps for in the last couple of weekends. But just wanted to mention a couple horses. Regal Glory, as I mentioned, in the Jenny Wiley Stakes, gave Chad Brown a record fifth win in the Jenny Wiley, broke the record of Bill Mott and his old boss and mentor, Chad Brown. Regal Glory is obviously such a great hard-knocking horse, always shows up, definitely a win machine. Cheryl Spite had a little bit of an upset win in the Maker's Mark Mile. Really great ride by Louis Size to get that horse up on the wire. But the horse that I thought was the most, actually, I wanted to mention Jackie's Warrior too. Shout out to Kirk and Judy Robinson, fans and friends of the show. Jackie's Warrior returned in his first win and was victorious in the Count Fleet handicap at Oaklawn. First start as a 4-year-old, obviously after becoming champion male sprinter last year. But the horse I wanted to mention the most and the one that stood out to me was Campanelle in the Giants Causeway. And it kind of goes on, it kind of builds on a strong meet of horses that Wesley Ward might be able to take to Royal Ascot and have some success. Talk about Golden Pal, some of the 2-year-olds. I thought she was crazy impressive in that race. She's a horse that's had some moments before, you know, overseas as well. She was wide all the way around the turn in that race and just finished up like a freight train. I thought that she was going to get beat with the trip that she had, and she was just crazy impressive and ran away from that field in the stretch. Obviously, lesser competition and a listed stake that she's going to face at Royal Ascot. But, you know, as far as the horses that ran this weekend, I thought she was the most impressive. What were your thoughts, Bill?
Well, I don't want to talk about who was most impressive, but I thought one of the stories this week was Joe, and you know, probably people are getting tired. And I know you're getting tired of me hearing this, but how about in the Lexington Stakes? A bunch of guys were looking to get Derby points, and God forbid, Brad Cox ran a horse back in 2 weeks in Tawny Port. Did the horse disintegrate or blow up, or, you know, now needs a 3 years off after doing that? No. Tawny Port won and is now going on to the Kentucky Derby. Ethereal Road, Wayne Lucas, who marches to the beat of his own drummer, old school trainer, he ran Ethereal Road back in 1 week. Now, it didn't work. The horse ran fourth, but same sort of thing. Guys, trainers, you don't need to take 17 weeks off between each start. It's okay to run horses back in 2 weeks. So good for Brad Cox, good for Wayne Lucas. I don't think Tawny Port has much of a chance in the Kentucky Derby, but, you know, he stepped out on a limb a little bit and it worked, and he's got the horse in the Derby now. Good for him.
Well, that kind of leads me into this weekend's preview, because not a ton of big racing, but we got a lot of good fillies and mares in action this weekend. And Malathot is making her 4-year-old debut after winning champion 3-year-old filly last year. I thought it was interesting that she is going to run in the Double Dog Dare on Friday at Keeneland. Now, it's a decent sized purse. It's $300,000, and it's obviously a much softer spot than the Apple Blossom. The Apple Blossom is Saturday at Oaklawn. $1 million purse. Latruska's in there, so maybe not wanting to face Latruska off the layoff, but also Clarier, CC. It's only a 5-horse field, but I think star power wise, it's an intriguing race in the Apple Blossom. But I thought it was a little curious to see Malathot in there. Bill, what do you think? You just want to avoid?
I guess Todd Pletcher and the team wants to give her, doesn't want to hold her feet to the fire first time out. And like you said, I mean, the Apple Blossom is not a big field, but it's going to be loaded. And think about this, Joe. Between the two races, 3 filly champions are coming back this weekend. Malathot was the 3-year-old filly champion. CC was the filly mare sprint champion and beating out John Green's favorite horse, Gamine. And then, of course, Latruska was the older filly and mare champion. It's a deep and loaded division, especially if CC continues to go in longer races where, you know, she's proven that she's very good at 7 furlongs. And now they're going back to, the mile and eighth distance. So, you know, it's also interesting. Remember, in past years, Oakland would be closed by now. They've extended the meet, and it's given us, as much as we love the Derby and the preps, the weeks in between, it can be kind of dogs, so to speak. But, you know, it's nice that Oakland is with another champion coming back last week in Jackie's Warrior, and now the big race at Oakland this Saturday. So, I mean, I'm still a Latruska fan until proven otherwise. She'll be my number one and the horse I'll pick in there. But fascinating race and a big weekend from the fillies.
Yeah, and it's kind of full circle for Latruska, because last year in the Apple Blossom was kind of where she became a star when she was able to beat back Monomoy Girl in that stretch run. So, yeah, she's always appointment viewing when she watches, but a bunch of other big fillies and mares to keep an eye on this weekend as well. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. You can learn more at westpointtb.com. As we mentioned in the interview with Steve Kornacki, Steve Kornacki is a partner at West Point, so they're always expanding their reach and bringing in more partners. West Point was in action early in the OBS April sale. In the first session, they purchased 5 2-year-olds, including Sons of Daredevil, Mohaman, Good Samaritan, and Runaway and Hyde, as well as a filly by Run Happy, purchased in partnership with Gervais Racing. West Point had a few nice winners this weekend as well, with Brigadier General, who broke his maiden on Friday at Keeneland, Elector, who got his second straight win of the year at Santa Anita on Saturday, and Got Thunder, who broke his maiden at Santa Anita on Sunday for John Sadler. So definitely a big weekend for West Point and all the partners. Congratulations. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse. Every step of the way, when it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. We have the latest stats for Legacy grads this year. So far, they've had 60 winners and 4 black type horses, including Grade 2 winner Temple and Kentucky Oaks hopeful Ain't Easy. Legacy graduate Fly Me Home broke her maiden this weekend at Laurel. The daughter of Temple City was the highest priced yearling by her sire, the 2020 Keeneland September yearling sales. As I mentioned last week, yearling sale season is right around the corner, so definitely give Tommy or Wendy a shout. Let's check out Remy's cartoon for this weekend. We'll look back in time to April 1875. The Louisville Jockey Club was trying to figure out what they should name the Kentucky Derby colloquially. It's the run for the, and there's a bunch of options. They ended up picking Roses, which I think sounds right because we've heard it so long, but also because of the alliteration. But I don't know, run for the daffodils. I like daffodils. I wouldn't mind a blanket of daffodils. There's a bunch of other options as well, but I guess we'll stick with run for the roses. All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. Don't forget, the Keeneland April Horses of Racing Age sale is after the races on April 29th, which is closing day next Friday. You can go to april.keeneland.com to learn more. I want to thank Bill Finley, our Green Group guest of the week, Steve Kornacki, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petroniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. Will you see you next week? Live from Keeneland. Can't wait.